lying there, he nodded and said, "Good." But I was tired of repeating the same story over and over. It seemed as if I had never talked so much in my life. After a short silence, he stood up and told me that he wanted to help me, that I interested him, and that, with God's help, he would do something for me. But first, he wanted to ask me a few more questions. Without working up to it, he asked if I loved Maman. I said yes, the same as anyone. And the clerk, who up to then had been typing steadily, must have hit the wrong key because he lost his place and had to go back. Again, without any apparent logic, the magistrate then asked if I had fired all 5 shots at once. I thought for a minute and explained that at first I had fired a single shot, and then a few seconds later the other 4. Then he said, "Why did you pause between the first and second shot?" Once again, I could see the red sand and feel the burning of the sun on my forehead. But this time I didn't answer. In the silence that followed, the magistrate seemed to be getting fidgety. He sat down, ran his fingers through his hair, put his elbows on his desk, and leaned toward me slightly with a strange look on his face. "Why? Why did you shoot at a body that was on the ground?" Once again, I didn't know how to answer. The magistrate ran his hands across his forehead and repeated his question with a slightly different tone in his voice. "Why? You must tell me. Why?" Still, I didn't say anything. Suddenly, he stood up, strode over to a far corner of his office, and pulled out a drawer in a file cabinet. He took out a silver crucifix, which he brandished as he came toward me. And in a completely different, almost cracked voice, he shouted, "Do you know what this is?" I said, "Yes, of course." Speaking very quickly and passionately, he told me that he believed in God, that it was his conviction that no man was so guilty that God would not forgive him. But in order for that to happen, a man must repent, and in so doing become like a child whose heart is open and ready to embrace all. He was leaning all the way over the table. He was waving his crucifix almost directly over my head. To tell the truth, I had found it very hard to follow his reasoning, first because I was hot and there were big flies in his office that kept landing on my face, and also because he was scaring me a little. At the same time, I knew that that was ridiculous because, after all, I was the criminal. He went on anyway. I vaguely understood that to his mind there was just one thing that wasn't clear in my confession, the fact that I had hesitated before I fired my second shot. The rest was fine, but that part he couldn't understand. I was about to tell him he was wrong to dwell on it, because it really didn't matter. But he cut me off and urged me one last time, drawing himself up to his full height and asking me if I believed in God. I said no. He sat down indignantly. He said it was impossible. All men believed in God, even those who turned their backs on him. That was his belief, and if he were ever to doubt it, his life would become meaningless. "Do you want my life to be meaningless?" he shouted. As far as I could see, it didn't have anything to do with me, and I told him so. But from across the table, he had already thrust the crucifix in my face and was screaming irrationally. "I am a Christian. I ask him to forgive you your sins. How can you not believe that he suffered for you?" I was struck by how sincere he seemed, but I had had enough. It was getting hotter and hotter. As always, whenever I want to get rid of someone I'm not really listening to, I made it appear as if I agreed. To my surprise, he acted triumphant. "You see? You see?" he said. "You do believe, don't you? And you're going to place your trust in him, aren't you?" Obviously, I again said no. He fell back in his chair. He seemed to be very tired. He didn't say anything for a minute, while the typewriter, which hadn't let up the whole time, was still tapping out the last few sentences. Then he looked at me closely, and with a little sadness in his face. In a low voice, he said, I have never seen a soul as hardened as yours. The criminals who have come before me have always wept at the sight of this image of suffering. I was about to say that that was precisely because they were criminals. But then I realized that I was one too. It was an idea I couldn't get used to. Then the judge stood up, as if to give me the signal that the examination was over. He simply asked, in the same weary tone, if I was sorry for what I had done. I thought about it for a minute, and said that more than sorry, I felt kind of annoyed. I got the impression he didn't understand. But that was as far as things went that day. After that, I saw a lot of the magistrate, except that my lawyer was with me each time. But it was just a matter of clarifying certain things in my previous statements, or else the magistrate would discuss the charges with my lawyer. But on those occasions, they never really paid much attention to me. Anyway, the tone of the questioning gradually changed. The magistrate seemed to have lost interest in me, and to have come to some sort of decision about my case. He didn't talk to me about God anymore, and I never saw him as worked up as he was that first day. The result was that our discussions became more cordial. A few questions, a brief conversation with my lawyer, and the examinations were over. As the magistrate put it, my case was taking its course. And then sometimes, when the conversation was of a more general nature, I would be included. I started to breathe more freely. No one in any of these meetings was rough with me. Everything was so natural, so well handled, and so calmly acted out, that I had the ridiculous impression of being one of the family. And I can say that at the end of the 11 months that this investigation lasted, I was almost surprised that I had ever enjoyed anything other than those rare moments when the judge would lead me to the door of his office, slap me on the shoulder, and say to me cordially, "That's all for today, Monsieur Antichrist." I would then be handed back over to the police. Chapter 2. There are some things I've never liked talking about. A few days after I entered prison, I realized that I wouldn't like talking about this part of my life. Later on, though, I no longer saw any point to my reluctance. In fact, I wasn't really in prison those first few days. I was sort of waiting for something to happen. It was only after Marie's first and last visit that it all started. From the day I got her letter, she told me she would no longer be allowed to come because she wasn't my wife. From that day on, I felt that I was at home in my cell, and that my life was coming to a standstill there. The day of my arrest, I was first put in a room where there were already several other prisoners, most of them Arabs. They laughed when they saw me. Then they asked what I was in for. I said I'd killed an Arab, and they were all silent. A few minutes later, it got dark. They showed me how to fix the mat I was supposed to sleep on. One end could be rolled up to make a pillow. All night I felt bugs crawling over my face. A few days later, I was put in a cell by myself, where I slept on wooden boards suspended from the wall. I had a bucket for a toilet and a tin wash basin. The prison was on the heights above the town, and through a small window I could see the sea. One day as I was gripping the bars, my face straining toward the light, a guard came in and told me I had a visitor. I thought it must be Marie. It was. To get to the visiting room, I went down a long corridor, then down some stairs, and finally another corridor. I walked into a very large room brightened by a huge bay window. The room was divided into three sections by two large grates that ran the length of the room. Between the two grates was a space of 8 to 10 meters, which separated the visitors from the prisoners. I spotted Marie, standing at the opposite end of the room with her striped dress and her suntanned face. On my side of the room, there were about 10 prisoners, most of them Arabs. Marie was surrounded by Moorish women and found herself between two visitors. A little thin-lipped old woman dressed in black, then a fat, bareheaded woman who was talking at the top of her voice and making lots of gestures. Because of the distance between the grates, the visitors and the prisoners were forced to speak very loud. When I walked in, the sound of the voices echoing off the room's high bare walls and the harsh light pouring out of the sky onto the windows and spilling into the room brought on a kind of dizziness. My cell was quieter and darker. It took me a few seconds to adjust, but eventually I could see each face clearly, distinctly in the bright light. I noticed there was a guard sitting at the far end of the passage between the two grates. Most of the Arab prisoners and their families had squatted down facing each other. They weren't shouting. Despite the commotion, they were managing to make themselves heard by talking in very low voices. Their subdued murmuring, coming from lower down, formed a kind of bass accompaniment to the conversations crossing above their heads. I took all this in very quickly as I made my way toward Marie. Already pressed up against the grate, she was smiling her best smile for me. I thought she looked very beautiful, but I didn't know how to tell her. "Well," she called across to me. "Well, here I am. Are you all right? Do you have everything you want?" "Yes, everything." We stopped talking, and Marie went on smiling. The fat woman yelled to the man next to me, her husband probably, a tall blonde guy with an honest face. It was the continuation of a conversation already underway. Jean wouldn't take him, she shouted as loudly as she could. "Uh-huh," said the man. "I told her you'd take him back when you get out, but she wouldn't take him." Then it was Marie's turn to shout, that Raymond sent his regards, and I said thanks. But my voice was drowned out by the man next to me, who asked, "Is he all right?" His wife laughed and said, "He's never been better." The man on my left, a small young man with delicate hands, wasn't saying anything. I noticed that he was across from the little old lady and that they were staring intently at each other. But I didn't have time to watch them any longer because Marie shouted to me that I had to have hope. I said yes. I was looking at her as she said it, and I wanted to squeeze her shoulders through her dress. I wanted to feel the thin material, and I didn't really know what else I had to hope for other than that. But that was probably what Marie meant, because she was still smiling. All I could see was the sparkle of her teeth and the little folds of her eyes. She shouted again, "You'll get out and we'll get married." I answered, "You think so?" But it was mainly just to say something. Then, very quickly and still in a very loud voice, she said yes, that I would be acquitted and that we would go swimming again. But the other woman took her turn to shout and said that she had left a basket at the clerk's office. She was listing all the things she had put in it to make sure they were all there because they cost a lot of money. The young man and his mother were still staring at each other. The murmuring of the Arabs continued below us. Outside, the light seemed to surge up over the bay window. I was feeling a little sick, and I'd have liked to leave. The noise was getting painful. But on the other hand, I wanted to make the most of Marie's being there. I don't know how much time went by. Marie told me about her job, and she never stopped smiling. The murmuring, the shouting, and the conversations were crossing back and forth. The only oasis of silence was next to me where the small young man and the old woman were gazing at each other. One by one, the Arabs were taken away. Almost everyone stopped talking as soon as the first one left. The little old woman moved closer to the bars, and at the same moment, a guard motioned to her son. He said, "Goodbye, Maman," and she reached between two bars to give him a long, slow little wave. She left just as another man came in, hat in hand, and took her place. Another prisoner was brought in, and they talked excitedly but softly, because the room had once again grown quiet. They came for the man on my right, and his wife said to him, without lowering her voice, as if she hadn't noticed there was no need to shout anymore, "Take care of yourself and be careful." Then it was my turn. Marie threw me a kiss. I looked back before disappearing. She hadn't moved, and her face was still pressed against the bars with the same sad, forced smile on it. Shortly after that was when she wrote to me. And the things I've never liked talking about began. Anyway, I shouldn't exaggerate, and it was easier for me than for others. When I was first imprisoned, the hardest thing was that my thoughts were still those of a free man. For example, I would suddenly have the urge to be on a beach and to walk down to the water. As I imagined the sound of the first waves under my feet, my body entering the water, and the sense of relief it would give me, all of a sudden I would feel just how closed in I was by the walls of my cell. But that only lasted a few months. Afterwards, my only thoughts were those of a prisoner. I waited for the daily walk, which I took in the courtyard, or for a visit from my lawyer. The rest of the time I managed pretty well. At the time, I often thought that if I had had to live in the trunk of a dead tree, with nothing to do but look up at the sky flowering overhead, little by little, I would have gotten used to it. I would have waited for birds to fly by or clouds to mingle, just as here I waited to see my lawyer's ties. And just as in another world, I used to wait patiently until Saturday to hold Marie's body in my arms. Now, as I think back on it, I wasn't in a hollow tree trunk. There were others worse off than me. Anyway, it was one of Maman's ideas, and she often repeated it, that after a while you could get used to anything. Besides, I usually didn't take things so far. The first months were hard. But in fact, the effort I had to make helped pass the time. For example, I was tormented by my desire for a woman. It was only natural. I was young. I never thought specifically of Marie, but I thought so much about a woman, about women, about all the ones I had known, about all the circumstances in which I had enjoyed them, that my cell would be filled with their faces and crowded with my desires. In one sense, it threw me off balance. But in another, it killed time. I had ended up making friends with the head guard, who used to make the rounds with the kitchen hands at mealtime. He's the one who first talked to me about women. He told me it was the first thing the others complained about. I told him it was the same for me, and that I thought it was unfair treatment. But, he said, that's exactly why you're in prison. What do you mean, that's why? Well, yes, freedom. That's why. They've taken away your freedom. I'd never thought about that. I agreed. It's true, I said. Otherwise, what would be the punishment? Right. You see, you understand these things. The rest of them don't. But they just end up doing it by themselves. The guard left after that. There were the cigarettes, too. When I entered prison, they took away my belt, my shoelaces, my tie, and everything I had in my pockets, my cigarettes in particular. Once I was in my cell, I asked to have them back, but I was told I wasn't allowed. The first few days were really rough. That may be the thing that was hardest for me. I would suck on chips of wood that I broke off my bed planks. I walked around nauseated all day long. I couldn't understand why they had taken them away when they didn't hurt anybody. Later on, I realized that that, too, was part of the punishment. But by then I had gotten used to not smoking, and it wasn't a punishment anymore. Apart from these annoyances, I wasn't too unhappy. Once again, the main problem was killing time. Eventually, once I learned how to remember things, I wasn't bored at all. Sometimes I would get to thinking about my room, and in my imagination, I would start at one corner and circle the room, mentally noting everything there was on the way. At first it didn't take long, but every time I started over it took a little longer. I would remember every piece of furniture, and on every piece of furniture every object, and of every object all the details. And of the details themselves, a flake, a crack, or a chipped edge, the color and the texture. At the same time, I would try not to lose the thread of my inventory, to make a complete list, so that after a few weeks, I could spend hours just enumerating the things that were in my room. And the more I thought about it, the more I dug out of my memory things I had overlooked or forgotten. I realized then that a man who had lived only one day could easily live for 100 years in prison. He would have enough memories to keep him from being bored. In a way, it was an advantage. Then there was sleep. At first, I didn't sleep well at night, and not at all during the day. Little by little, my nights got better, and I was able to sleep during the day, too. In fact, during the last few months, I've been sleeping 16 to 18 hours a day. That would leave me 6 hours to kill with meals, nature's call, my memories, and the story about the Czechoslovakian. Between my straw mattress and the bed planks, I had actually found an old scrap of newspaper, yellow and transparent, half stuck to the canvas. On it was a news story, the first part of which was missing, but which must have taken place in Czechoslovakia. A man had left a Czech village to seek his fortune. 25 years later, and now rich, he had returned with a wife and child. His mother was running a hotel with his sister in the village where he'd been born. In order to surprise them, he had left his wife and child at another hotel and gone to see his mother, who didn't recognize him when he walked in. As a joke, he'd had the idea of taking a room. He had shown off his money. During the night, his mother and his sister had beaten him to death with a hammer in order to rob him and had thrown his body in the river. The next morning, the wife had come to the hotel and, without knowing it, gave away the traveler's identity. The mother hanged herself. The sister threw herself down a well. I must have read that story 1,000 times. On the one hand, it wasn't very likely. On the other, it was perfectly natural. Anyway, I thought the traveler pretty much deserved what he got, and that you should never play games. So, with all the sleep, my memories, reading my crime story, and the alternation of light and darkness, time passed. Of course, I had read that eventually you wind up losing track of time in prison, but it hadn't meant much to me when I'd read it. I hadn't understood how days could be both long and short at the same time. Long to live through, maybe, but so drawn out that they ended up flowing into one another. They lost their names. Only the words yesterday and tomorrow still had any meaning for me. One day when the guard told me that I'd been in for 5 months, I believed it, but I didn't understand it. For me, it was one and the same unending day that was unfolding in my cell and the same thing I was trying to do. That day, after the guard had left, I looked at myself in my tin plate. My reflection seemed to remain serious even though I was trying to smile at it. I moved the plate around in front of me. I smiled, and it still had the same sad, stern expression. It was near the end of the day, the time of day I don't like talking about. That nameless hour when the sounds of evening would rise up from every floor of the prison in a cortege of silence. I moved closer to the window, and in the last light of day I gazed at my reflection one more time. It was still serious. And what was surprising about that, since at that moment I was too? But at the same time, and for the first time in months, I distinctly heard the sound of my own voice. I recognized it as the same one that had been ringing in my ears for many long days, and I realized that all that time I had been talking to myself. Then I remembered what the nurse at Maman's funeral said. No. There was no way out. And no one can imagine what nights in prison are like. Chapter 3. But I can honestly say that the time from summer to summer went very quickly, and I knew as soon as the weather turned hot that something new was in store for me. My case was set down for the last session of the Court of Assizes, and that session was due to end sometime in June. The trial opened with the sun glaring outside. My lawyer had assured me that it wouldn't last more than 2 or 3 days. Besides, he had added, the court will be pressed for time. Yours isn't the most important case of the session. Right after you, there's a parricide coming up. They came for me at 7:30 in the morning, and I was driven to the courthouse in the prison van. The two policemen took me into a small room that smelled of darkness. We waited. Seated near a door through which we could hear voices, shouts, chairs being dragged across the floor, and a lot of commotion which made me think of those neighborhood fetes when the hall is cleared for dancing after the concert. The policeman told me we had to wait for the judges, and one of them offered me a cigarette, which I turned down. Shortly after that, he asked me if I had the jitters. I said no, and that, in a way, I was even interested in seeing a trial. I'd never had the chance before. Yeah, said the other policeman, but it gets a little boring after a while. A short time later, a small bell rang in the room. Then they took my handcuffs off. They opened the door and led me into the dock. The room was packed. Despite the blinds, the sun filtered through in places and the air was already stifling. They hadn't opened the windows. I sat down with the policemen standing on either side of me. It was then that I noticed a row of faces in front of me. They were all looking at me. I realized that they were the jury. But I can't say what distinguished one from another. I had just one impression. I was sitting across from a row of seats on a streetcar, and all these anonymous passengers were looking over the new arrival to see if they could find something funny about him. I knew it was a silly idea, since it wasn't anything funny they were after but a crime. There isn't much difference, though. In any case, that was the idea that came to me. I was feeling a little dizzy, too, with all those people in that stuffy room. I looked around the courtroom again, but I couldn't make out a single face. I think that at first I hadn't realized that all those people were crowding in to see me. Usually people didn't pay much attention to me. It took some doing on my part to understand that I was the cause of all the excitement. I said to the policeman, "Some crowd." He told me it was because of the press, and he pointed to a group of men at a table just below the jury box. He said, "That's them." I asked, "Who?" And he repeated, "The press." He knew one of the reporters, who just then spotted him and was making his way toward us. He was an older, friendly man with a twisted little grin on his face. He gave the policeman a warm handshake. I noticed then that everyone was waving and exchanging greetings and talking, as if they were in a club where people are glad to find themselves among others from the same world. That is how I explained to myself the strange impression I had of being odd man out, a kind of intruder. Yet the reporter turned and spoke to me with a smile. He told me that he hoped everything would go well for me. I thanked him, and he added, "You know, we've blown your case up a little. Summer is the slow season for the news, and your story and the parricide were the only ones worth bothering about." Then he pointed in the direction of the group he had just left, at a little man who looked like a fattened-up weasel. He told me that the man was a special correspondent for a Paris paper. "Actually, he didn't come because of you, but since they assigned him to cover the parricide trial, they asked him to send a dispatch about your case at the same time." And again, I almost thanked him. But I thought that that would be ridiculous. He waved cordially, shyly, and left us. We waited a few more minutes. My lawyer arrived, in his gown, surrounded by lots of colleagues. He walked over to the reporters and shook some hands. They joked and laughed and looked completely at ease, until the moment when the bell in the court rang. Everyone went back to his place. My lawyer walked over to me, shook my hand, and advised me to respond briefly to the questions that would be put to me, not to volunteer anything, and to leave the rest to him. To my left, I heard the sound of a chair being pulled out, and I saw a tall, thin man, dressed in red, and wearing a pince-nez, who was carefully folding his robe as he sat down. A bailiff said, "All rise." At the same time, two large fans started to whir. Three judges, two in black, the third in red, entered with files in hand and walked briskly to the rostrum, which dominated the room. The man in the red gown sat on the chair in the middle, set his cap down in front of him, wiped his bald little head with a handkerchief, and announced that the court was now in session. The reporters already had their pens in hand. They all had the same indifferent and somewhat snide look on their faces. One of them, however, much younger than the others, wearing gray flannels and a blue tie, had left his pen lying in front of him and was looking at me. All I could see in his slightly lopsided face were his two very bright eyes, which were examining me closely, without betraying any definable emotion. And I had the odd impression of being watched by myself. Maybe it was for that reason, and also because I wasn't familiar with all the procedures, that I didn't quite understand everything that happened next. The drawing of lots for the jury. The questions put by the presiding judge to my lawyer, the prosecutor, and the jury. Each time, the jurors' heads would all turn toward the bench at the same time. The quick reading of the indictment, in which I recognized names of people and places, and some more questions to my lawyer. Anyway, the presiding judge said he was going to proceed with the calling of witnesses. The bailiff read off some names that caught my attention. In the middle of what until then had been a shapeless mass of spectators, I saw them stand up one by one, only to disappear again through a side door. The director and the caretaker from the home, old Thomas Perez, Raymond, Masson, Salamano, and Marie. She waved to me, anxiously. I was still feeling surprised that I hadn't seen them before when Celeste, the last to be called, stood up. I recognized next to him the little woman from the restaurant, with her jacket and her stiff and determined manner. She was staring right at me. But I didn't have time to think about them because the presiding judge started speaking. He said that the formal proceedings were about to begin and that he didn't think he needed to remind the public to remain silent. According to him, he was there to conduct in an impartial manner the proceedings of a case which he would consider objectively. The verdict returned by the jury would be taken in a spirit of justice, and in any event, he would have the courtroom cleared at the slightest disturbance. It was getting hotter, and I could see the people in the courtroom fanning themselves with newspapers, which made a continuous low rustling sound. The presiding judge gave a signal, and the bailiff brought over three fans made of woven straw, which the three judges started waving immediately. My examination began right away. The presiding judge questioned me calmly and even, it seemed to me, with a hint of cordiality. Once again he had me state my name, age, date, and place of birth, and although it irritated me, I realized it was only natural because it would be a very serious thing to try the wrong man. Then he reread the narrative of what I'd done, turning to me every few sentences to ask, "Is that correct?" Each time I answered, "Yes, Your Honor," as my lawyer had instructed me to do. It took a long time because the judge went into minute detail in his narrative. The reporters were writing the whole time. I was conscious of being watched by the youngest of them and by the little robot woman. Everyone in the row of streetcar seats was turned directly toward the judge, who coughed, leafed through his file, and turned toward me, fanning himself. He told me that he now had to turn to some questions that might seem irrelevant to my case, but might in fact have a significant bearing on it. I knew right away he was going to talk about Mama again, and at the same time, I could feel how much it irritated me. He asked me why I had put Mama in the home. I answered that it was because I didn't have the money to have her looked after and cared for. He asked me if it had been hard on me, and I answered that Mama and I didn't expect anything from each other anymore, or from anyone else either, and that we had both gotten used to our new lives. The judge then said that he didn't want to dwell on this point, and he asked the prosecutor if he had any further questions. The prosecutor had his back half turned to me, and without looking at me, he stated that, with the court's permission, he would like to know whether I had gone back to the spring by myself, intending to kill the Arab. No, I said. Well then, why was I armed, and why did I return to precisely that spot? I said it just happened that way. And the prosecutor noted in a nasty voice, that will be all for now. After that, things got a little confused, at least for me. But after some conferring, the judge announced that the hearing was adjourned until the afternoon, at which time the witnesses would be heard. I didn't even have time to think. I was taken out, put into the van, and driven to the prison, where I had something to eat. After a very short time, just long enough for me to realize I was tired, they came back for me. The whole thing started again, and I found myself in the same courtroom in front of the same faces. Only, it was much hotter. And, as if by some miracle, each member of the jury, the prosecutor, my lawyer, and some of the reporters too, had been provided with straw fans. The young reporter and the little robot woman were still there. They weren't fanning themselves, but they were still watching me without saying a word. I wiped away the sweat covering my face, and I had barely become aware of where I was and what I was doing when I heard the director of the home being called. He was asked whether Mama ever complained about me, and he said yes, but that some of it was just a way the residents all had of complaining about their relatives. The judge had him clarify whether she used to reproach me for having put her in the home, and the director again said yes, but this time he didn't add anything else. To another question he replied that he had been surprised by my calm the day of the funeral. He was asked what he meant by calm. The director then looked down at the tips of his shoes and said that I hadn't wanted to see Mama, that I hadn't cried once, and that I had left right after the funeral without paying my last respects at her grave. And one other thing had surprised him. One of the men who worked for the undertaker had told him I didn't know how old Mama was. There was a brief silence, and then the judge asked him if he was sure I was the man he had just been speaking of. The director didn't understand the question, so the judge told him it's a formality. He then asked the prosecutor if he had any questions to put to the witness, and the prosecutor exclaimed, "Oh, no, that is quite sufficient," with such glee and with such a triumphant look in my direction that for the first time in years I had this stupid urge to cry because I could feel how much all these people hated me. After asking the jury and my lawyer if they had any questions, the judge called the caretaker. The same ritual was repeated for him as for all the others. As he took the stand, the caretaker glanced at me and then looked away. He answered the questions put to him. He said I hadn't wanted to see Mama, that I had smoked and slept some, and that I had had some coffee. It was then I felt a stirring go through the room, and for the first time, I realized that I was guilty. The caretaker was asked to repeat the part about the coffee and the cigarette. The prosecutor looked at me with an ironic gleam in his eye. At that point, my lawyer asked the caretaker if it wasn't true that he had smoked a cigarette with me. But the prosecutor objected vehemently to this question. Who is on trial here? And what kind of tactics are these? Trying to taint the witnesses for the prosecution in an effort to detract from testimony that remains nonetheless overwhelming? In spite of all that, the judge directed the caretaker to answer the question. The old man looked embarrassed and said, "I know I was wrong to do it, but I couldn't refuse the cigarette when Monsieur offered it to me." Lastly, I was asked if I had anything to add. "Nothing," I said, "except that the witness is right. It's true. I did offer him a cigarette." The caretaker gave me a surprised and somehow grateful look. He hesitated, and then he said that he was the one who offered me the coffee. My lawyer was exultant and stated loudly that the jury would take note of the fact. But the prosecutor shouted over our heads and said, "Indeed, the gentlemen of the jury will take note of the fact, and they will conclude that a stranger may offer a cup of coffee, but that beside the body of the one who brought him into the world, A son should have refused it. The caretaker went back to his bench. When Tomás Pérez's turn came, a bailiff had to hold him up and help him get to the witness stand. Pérez said it was really my mother he had known, and that he had seen me only once, on the day of the funeral. He was asked how I had acted that day, and he replied, "You understand, I was too sad, so I didn't see anything. My sadness made it impossible to see anything, because for me it was a very great sadness, and I even fainted, so I wasn't able to see Monsieur." The prosecutor asked him if he had at least seen me cry. Pérez answered no. The prosecutor in turn said, "The gentlemen of the jury will take note." But my lawyer got angry. He asked Pérez, in what seemed to be an exaggerated tone of voice, if he had seen me not cry. Pérez said no. The spectators laughed. And my lawyer, rolling up one of his sleeves, said with finality, "Here we have the perfect reflection of this entire trial. Everything is true and nothing is true." The prosecutor had a blank expression on his face, and with a pencil he was poking holes in the title page of his case file. After a 5-minute recess, during which my lawyer told me that everything was working out for the best, we heard the testimony of Celeste, who was called by the defense. The defense meant me. Every now and then Celeste would glance over in my direction and rotate his Panama hat in his hands. He was wearing the new suit he used to put on to go out with me to the races sometimes on Sundays, but I think he must not have been able to get his collar on, because he only had a brass stud keeping his shirt fastened. He was asked if I was a customer of his, and he said yes, but he was also a friend. What he thought of me? And he answered that I was a man. What he meant by that? And he stated that everybody knew what that meant. If he had noticed that I was ever withdrawn, and all he would admit was that I didn't speak unless I had something to say. The prosecutor asked him if I kept up with my bill. Celeste laughed and said, "Between us, those were just details." He was again asked what he thought about my crime. He put his hands on the edge of the box, and you could tell he had something prepared. He said, "The way I see it, it's bad luck. Everybody knows what bad luck is. It leaves you defenseless. And there it is. The way I see it, it's bad luck." He was about to go on, but the judge told him that that would be all and thanked him. Celeste was a little taken aback, but he stated that he had more to say. He was asked to be brief. He again repeated that it was bad luck. And the judge said, "Yes, fine, but we are here to judge just this sort of bad luck. Thank you." And as if he had reached the end of both his knowledge and his goodwill, Celeste then turned toward me. It looked to me as if his eyes were glistening and his lips were trembling. He seemed to be asking me what else he could do. I said nothing. I made no gesture of any kind, but it was the first time in my life I ever wanted to kiss a man. The judge again instructed him to step down. Celeste went and sat among the spectators. He sat there throughout the entire trial, leaning forward, his elbows on his knees, the Panama hat in his hands, listening to everything that was said. Marie entered. She had put on a hat, and she was still beautiful. But I liked her better with her hair loose. From where I was sitting, I could just make out the slight fullness of her breasts, and I recognized the little pout of her lower lip. She seemed very nervous. Right away she was asked how long she had known me. She said since the time she worked in our office. The judge wanted to know what her relation to me was. She said she was my friend. To another question she answered yes, it was true that she was supposed to marry me. Flipping through a file, the prosecutor asked her bluntly when our liaison had begun. She indicated the date. The prosecutor remarked indifferently that if he was not mistaken, that was the day after Mama died. Then, in a slightly ironic tone, he said that he didn't mean to dwell on such a delicate matter, and that he fully appreciated Marie's misgivings, but, and here his tone grew firmer, that he was duty-bound to go beyond propriety. So he asked Marie to describe briefly that day when I had first known her. Marie didn't want to, but at the prosecutor's insistence, she went over our swim, the movies, and going back to my place. The prosecutor said that after Marie had given her statements to the examining magistrate, he had consulted the movie listings for that day. He added that Marie herself would tell the court what film was showing. In an almost expressionless voice, she did in fact tell the court that it was a Fernandel film. By the time she had finished, there was complete silence in the courtroom. The prosecutor then rose, and very gravely, and with what struck me as real emotion in his voice, his finger pointing at me, said slowly and distinctly, "Gentlemen of the jury, the day after his mother's death, this man was out swimming, starting up a dubious liaison, and going to the movies, a comedy, for laughs. I have nothing further to say." He sat down in the still silent courtroom. But all of a sudden Marie began to sob, saying it wasn't like that. There was more to it, and that she was being made to say the opposite of what she was thinking. That she knew me and I hadn't done anything wrong. But at a signal from the judge, the bailiff ushered her out and the trial proceeded. Hardly anyone listened after that, when Masson testified that I was an honest man, and I'd even say, a decent one. Hardly anyone listened to Salamano either, when he recalled how I had been good